Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a recording about a building near the birthplace of John Lennon, co-founder of the Beatles. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Was the Gothic Revival mansion known as Strawberry Field, without an S. It had passed into the hands of the Salvation Army in 1934 and was opened as a children's home in the presence of Evangeline Booth, the daughter of the Army's founder, William. As boys, John Lennon and my older brother David were friends. Their many escapades at the village church of St Peter's, the Sunday school, church choir and the Scouts would do credit to Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. But perhaps John got up to most mischief at Quarrybank High School, sandwiched between the glorious Harthill Park and Penny Lane, which inspired the other song of that double A-side single, Strawberry Fields, with an S. At Quarrybank, we boys came under an inspirational headmaster in Bill Popjoy. Famous alumni of this sometime Eton of the Labour Party have included the cabinet ministers Peter Shaw and Bill Rogers, and footballers Joe Royle and Steve Coppell. They also include artistic director of London's South Bank Centre, Jude Kelly. Not all its pupils seemed conventionally promising, though, and Popjoy was often exasperated by Lennon's cheeky delinquency. On one occasion, when he was caught tearing pages from his school Bible and launching them from the geography room attic window, Lennon explained that he was spreading the word. When I see Strawberry Fields' much-visited red gates today, I look beyond them to the atmospheric grounds. In the 1950s, farm fields extended across the back of Strawberry Field, past a remand home for delinquent boys, the Naughty Boys' Home, to John's house called Mendip's on Menlove Avenue. My friends and I were among those who, like John, would clamber into the grounds of Strawberry Field, a magic place with its psychedelic rhododendron bushes, wild rabbits, and an annual summer fete, complete with a Salvation Army brass band, coconut shy, and other amusement stalls. These experiences would, I'm convinced, later provide some of the inspiration for the Sgt. Pepper album. For John, an orphan of sorts, abandoned by his father, passed to his Auntie Mimi to be brought up, it had always been a special place, so close to his home, but so handy to provide an edginess and sense of the other. This will have resonated with his sense of being a perpetual outsider and campaigner for the underdog. And when the Beatles saw success, he provided support to the orphanage. John was shot, of course, in 1980. The children's home closed 25 years later and was finally demolished. Now, 50 years on, Strawberry Fields' rejuvenation is underway. A new pavilion, respectful of the site's significance, its legend and its environment, is under construction. Yet when I was there recently, I was struck by how much of the landscape remains atmospherically intact. When completed, the new Strawberry Field will spread the word about the small proportion of young adults with learning disabilities who are actually in work. It'll offer them education and training, that will make it possible for them to enter the world of work and normal everyday life and help them realise their dreams. Drawing on the miasma of creativity that inspired John Lennon, Strawberry Field, in its latest incarnation, will provide new hope to a special group of people while continuing to inspire Beatles fans around the world. Among them was the Gothic Revival mansion known as Strawberry Field, without an S. It had passed into the hands of the Salvation Army in 1934 and was opened as a children's home in the presence of Evangeline Booth, the daughter of the Army's founder, William. As boys, John Lennon and my older brother David were friends. Their many escapades at the village church of St Peter's, the Sunday school, church choir and the Scouts would do credit to Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, but perhaps John got up to most mischief at Quarrybank High School, sandwiched between the glorious Hart Hill Park and Penny Lane, which inspired the other song of that double A-side single, Strawberry Fields, with an S. At Quarrybank, we boys came under an inspirational headmaster in Bill Popjoy. Famous alumni of this sometime Eton of the Labour Party have included the Cabinet Ministers Peter Shaw and Bill Rogers, and footballers Joe Royal and Steve Coppell. They also include Artistic Director of London's South Bank Centre, Jude Kelly. Not all its pupils seemed conventionally promising, though, and Popjoy was often exasperated by Lennon's cheeky delinquency. On one occasion, when he was caught tearing pages from his school Bible and launching them from the geography room attic window, Lennon explained that he was spreading the word. When I see Strawberry Fields' much-visited red gates today, I look beyond them to the atmospheric grounds. In the 1950s, farm fields extended across the back of Strawberry Field, past a remand home for delinquent boys, the Naughty Boys' Home, to John's house called Mendip's on Menlove Avenue. My friends and I were among those who, like John, would clamber into the grounds of Strawberry Field, a magic place with its psychedelic rhododendron bushes, wild rabbits, and an annual summer fete, complete with a Salvation Army brass band, coconut shy, and other amusement stalls. These experiences would, I'm convinced, later provide some of the inspiration for the Sgt. Pepper album. For John, an orphan of sorts, abandoned by his father, passed to his Auntie Mimi to be brought up, it had always been a special place, so close to his home, but so handy to provide an edginess and sense of the other. This will have resonated with his sense of being a perpetual outsider and campaigner for the underdog. And when the Beatles saw success, he provided support to the orphanage. John was shot, of course, in 1980. The children's home closed 25 years later and was finally demolished. Now, 50 years on, Strawberry Fields' rejuvenation is underway. A new pavilion, respectful of the site's significance, its legend and its environment, is under construction. Yet when I was there recently, I was struck by how much of the landscape remains atmospherically intact. When completed, the new Strawberry Field will spread the word about the small proportion of young adults with learning disabilities who are actually in work. It'll offer them education and training that will make it possible for them to enter the world of work and normal everyday life and help them realise their dreams. Drawing on the miasma of creativity that inspired John Lennon, Strawberry Field, in its latest incarnation, will provide new hope to a special group of people while continuing to inspire Beatles fans around the world.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a discussion about how to get information about the quality of food from its packaging. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 7 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Alexandra, you're doing your PhD on package labelling systems here and elsewhere. Could you explain to us briefly how our star rating system works? What do those stars tell us?
Yeah, so stars is one of about 32 of these kinds of systems that's been adopted now internationally. The star rating works as an overall rating on foods. So basically your food can go down if it's got a lot of saturated fat, sodium, sugar and energy, but you can get some points back for the fibre content, the protein and what we call fruit and vegetable content. That gives you an overall score from 0.5 to 5 stars.
And have all products in the supermarkets taken up the star rating system equally, or is it more common with some than others?
Yeah, so that's what my research has suggested is one of the main weaknesses of the system right now. So our studies last year showed that stars were still only on around 1/3 of all products, and the majority of those were ones that scored well. So there's very few products in the supermarket right now that show you if they're getting 1 or 2 stars, and we say that this isn't giving consumers the full picture.
So if they're only getting 1 or 2 stars, they tend not to have the stars at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's not perhaps not particularly surprising because this system is voluntary, though the two main supermarkets, Coles and Woolworths, should be commended because they have put stars on all their private label products, which make up thousands of products now in the supermarket, and they'll show you even if their products get 0.5 star.
So do you have a sense, Alexandra, of how much consumer confidence there is in the 5-star system? Do shoppers trust it?
Yeah, well, look, I've reviewed over 50 pieces of evidence that have come out since stars were implemented, and I think that stars are actually doing pretty well overall. So we know that consumers like and can understand them. They're certainly much better than the daily intake guide, which was the industry preferred system that they replaced. That was the one that had a lot of little numbers on the front. And there's no evidence that people can use that to make healthier choices. So I think they are a big step forward. What I expect you'll hear today on your feedback is that there's been a lot of attention on particular products that seem to score too highly. And the great thing about the review now is that we have a chance to improve those kinds of loopholes in the system and get on with making it mandatory so people can see stars on everything.
Geoffrey Anderson, you were on the project team that helped design the system. You're on the advisory committee, and the Australian Food and Grocery Council is happy to keep the system voluntary. But isn't that a problem if, as we've heard, foods that score a low star rating just opt out completely?
Well, I think the thing to remember is that the Health Star rating was brought in mid-2014. It was brought in for 5 years on a voluntary basis, and it was thought to be very much as a trial. And the end of the trial is now over as we go into the review period. The review has been actually going on for about 5 years, but certainly the Food and Grocery Council has supported it, and it has had a good reception amongst consumers, as Ali has said, with a high degree of trust and a high degree of use. It certainly has come on to products with high star ratings, but in the latter part of the 5 years, more and more products have also come onto the market with a lower star rating. I think the important thing is to recognise that it's been taken up at a much faster rate than was originally anticipated.
Still only on 1/3 of products, though. That's not very many.
Well, that's right. But I think if once the review comes in and if it gets continued support by the government, which we anticipate it will in one form or another, I think we'll see a much faster take-up in the future.
Alexandra, you're doing your PhD on package labelling systems here and elsewhere. Could you explain to us briefly how our star rating system works? What do those stars tell us?
Yeah, so STARS is one of about 32 of these kinds of systems that's been adopted now internationally. The star rating works as an overall rating on foods. So basically your food can go down if it's got a lot of saturated fat, sodium, sugar and energy, but you can get some points back for the fibre content, the protein and what we call fruit and vegetable content. That gives you an overall score from half to 5 stars.
And have all products in the supermarkets taken up the star rating system equally, or is it more common with some than others?
Yeah, so that's what my research has suggested is one of the main weaknesses of the system right now. So our studies last year showed that STARS were still only on around a third of all products, and the majority of those were ones that scored well. So there's very few products in the supermarket right now that show you if they're getting 1 or 2 stars, and we say that this isn't giving consumers the full picture.
So if they're only getting 1 or 2 stars, they tend not to have the stars at all?
Yeah, I mean, that's not... perhaps not particularly surprising because this system is voluntary, though the two main supermarkets, Coles and Woolworths, should be commended because they have put stars on all their private label products, which make up thousands of products now in the supermarket, and they'll show you even if their products get half a star.
So do you have a sense, Alexandra, of how much consumer confidence there is in the 5-star system? Do shoppers trust it?
Yeah, well, look, I've reviewed over 50 pieces of evidence that have come out since STARS were implemented, and I think that STARS are actually doing pretty well overall. So we know that consumers like and can understand them. They're certainly much better than the Daily Intake Guide, which was the industry-preferred system that they replaced. That was the one that had a lot of little numbers on the front, and there's no evidence that people can use that to make healthier choices. So I think they are a big step forward. What I expect you'll hear today on your feedback is that there's been a lot of attention on particular products that seem to score too highly. And the great thing about the review now is that we have a chance to improve those kinds of loopholes in the system and get on with making it mandatory so people can see stars on everything.
Geoffrey Anderson, you were on the project team that helped design the system. You're on the advisory committee, and the Australian Food and Grocery Council is happy to keep the system voluntary. But isn't that a problem if, as we've heard, foods that score a low star rating just opt out completely?
Well, I think the thing to remember is that the Health Star rating was brought in mid-2014. It was brought in for 5 years on a voluntary basis, and it was thought to be very much as a trial. And the end of the trial is now over as we go into the review period. The review has been actually going on for about 5 years, but certainly the Food and Grocery Council has supported it, and it has had a good reception amongst consumers, as Ali has said, with a high degree of trust and a high degree of use. It certainly has come on to products with high star ratings, but in the latter part of the 5 years, more and more products have also come onto the market with a lower star rating. I think the important thing is to recognise that it's been taken up at a much faster rate than was originally anticipated.
Still only on a third of products, though. That's not very many.
Well, that's right. But I think once the review comes in and if it gets continued support by the government, which we anticipate it will in one form or another, I think we'll see a much faster take-up in the future.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording from 2019 about a law to fight climate change. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 8 with the sentence endings A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
On the steps of New York City Hall, more than 100 people celebrated the passage of a landmark climate bill last week. It doesn't target cars or coal. It regulates big buildings.
Hey, hey, ho, ho! 30 buildings have to go! Hey, hey!
New York Mayor Bill de Blasio is expected to sign the bill into law soon. He says it's the first law in the world to require emissions cuts from existing buildings, and it could serve as a model for other cities. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
Think of New York City's famous skyscrapers. Now imagine the power it takes to heat and cool and illuminate them. And maybe it's not so surprising that buildings are responsible for two-thirds of the city's greenhouse gas emissions. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio called it the mother load in an interview with NPR.
These buildings are the single biggest piece of the problem that hasn't been addressed, and we have the tools to do it right now.
Everything about this new law is big. It focuses on big buildings and calls for big cuts to emissions, ultimately 80%. And if buildings don't comply, they will face big fines.
In the case of the biggest buildings, if these goals are not met, the fines can be $1 million per year or more even.
So what does it take for a building to slash its carbon emissions? Take a ride on the Empire State Building's elevator.
Welcome to the world's most famous building, and you get to see it built. Keep your arms and legs inside.
For the last 10 years, this landmark has gone through an ambitious energy efficiency overhaul. Tourists visiting the 102-story landmark can't see them, but retrofits are everywhere. Insulated windows, dimmable lights, upgraded air conditioning, tools for tenants to cut consumption. Even that elevator is more efficient.
There is no silver bullet. These are lots of little pieces. So we call it silver buckshot.
Anthony Malkin is the CEO of the Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the building.
When you reduce energy consumption, you reduce carbon output. It's very simple.
The Empire State Building has dramatically slashed both energy use and emissions. But New York City's new legislation ultimately calls for even more cuts.
This is absolutely a step that goes beyond anything that we've even accomplished in our buildings.
The new law will carry a hefty price tag. Collectively, the required retrofits will cost an estimated $4 billion. But that's just looking at the costs. There are savings, too, from lower bills over time. The Empire State Building spent millions on those retrofits, but it has already made back the investment and then some. So some of the required retrofits will pay for themselves. But de Blasio acknowledges that won't always be true.
They are the kinds of mandates that some building owners will find to be, you know, stretch goals and will find to be difficult, but that's the point.
That is, the law is designed to push owners to make changes they wouldn't otherwise. New York is already a very expensive city. Large commercial landlords are frustrated that they have to make changes when other buildings don't and suggest the law could drive business away. But the mayor emphasizes that financing will be available, and the bill's supporters respond to concerns over cost by pointing out that climate change poses an existential threat to this coastal city. They recall the devastating effects of Hurricane Sandy. Maritza Silva Farrell runs a nonprofit that pushed for the bill's passage.
The lives of our kids and our grandkids are at stake, and we really need to take bold actions.
She asks anyone running a cost analysis to remember to account for those human lives.
On the steps of New York City Hall, more than 100 people celebrated the passage of a landmark climate bill last week. It doesn't target cars or coal. It regulates big buildings. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio is expected to sign the bill into law soon. He says it's the first law in the world to require emissions cuts from existing buildings, and it could serve as a model for other cities. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
Think of New York City's famous skyscrapers. Now imagine the power it takes to heat and cool and illuminate them. And maybe it's not so surprising that buildings are responsible for two-thirds of the city's greenhouse gas emissions. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio called it the mother load in an interview with NPR.
These buildings are the single biggest piece of the problem that hasn't been addressed, and we had the tools to do it right now.
Everything about this new law is big. It focuses on big buildings and calls for big cuts to emissions, ultimately 80%. And if buildings don't comply, they will face big fines.
In the case of the biggest buildings, if these goals are not met, the fines can be $1 million per year or more even.
So what does it take for a building to slash its carbon emissions? Take a ride on the Empire State Building's elevator.
Welcome to the world's most famous building, and you get to see it built. Keep your arms and legs inside.
For the last 10 years, this landmark has gone through an ambitious energy efficiency overhaul. Tourists visiting the 102-story landmark can't see them, but retrofits are everywhere. Insulated windows, dimmable lights, upgraded air conditioning, tools for tenants to cut consumption, even that elevator is more efficient.
There is no silver bullet. These are lots of little pieces. So we call it silver buckshot.
Anthony Malkin is the CEO of the Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the building.
When you reduce energy consumption, you reduce carbon output. It's very simple.
The Empire State Building has dramatically slashed both energy use and emissions. But New York City's new legislation ultimately calls for even more cuts.
This is absolutely a step that goes beyond anything that we've even accomplished in our buildings.
The new law will carry a hefty price tag. Collectively, the required retrofits will cost an estimated $4 billion. But that's just looking at the costs. There are savings, too, from lower bills over time. The Empire State Building spent millions on those retrofits, but it has already made back the investment and then some. So some of the required retrofits will pay for themselves. But de Blasio acknowledges that won't always be true.
They are the kinds of mandates that some building owners will find to be, you know, stretch goals and will find to be difficult, but that's the point.
That is, the law is designed to push owners to make changes they wouldn't otherwise. New York is already a very expensive city. Large commercial landlords are frustrated that they have to make changes when other buildings don't and suggest the law could drive business away. But the mayor emphasizes that financing will be available, and the bill's supporters respond to concerns over cost by pointing out that climate change poses an existential threat to this coastal city. They recall the devastating effects of Hurricane Sandy. Maritza Silva Farrell runs a nonprofit that pushed for the bill's passage.
The lives of our kids and our grandkids are at stake, and we really need to take bold actions.
She asks anyone running a cost analysis to remember to account for those human lives.
Task 4. You are going to listen to Cheeky Sarkar talking about the smartphone revolution in India. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 9 with the sentence endings A to L. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
I live in a country the size of Europe, and it only has 50 decent bookshops. And Indians just didn't seem to want to read for fun. So if you look at all the bestseller lists in India, what you'll always find in the bestseller list is exam and professional guides. Imagine if you found the SAT guides as the New York Times number one seller month after month. And yet this smartphone revolution was creating readers and writers of a different kind. Whether it was on Facebook or WhatsApp, Indians were writing and sharing and reading all kinds of things. Terrible jokes, spurious pop history, long emotional confessions, diatribes against the government. And as I read and shared these things, I wondered to myself, could I get these writers and these readers, could I turn them into my readers? And so I left my plush corner office and my job as the publisher of India's top publishing company. And I set up on my own. I moved into a large room, single large room, in a cheap bohemian district of Delhi with a small team. And there I set up a new kind of publishing house. A new kind of publishing house needs a new kind of reader and a new kind of book. And so I asked myself, what would this new reader want? Would they prize urgency, relevance, timeliness, directness, the very qualities they seem to want from their online services, indeed the qualities they seem to want from life today? I knew that my readers were always on the go. I'd have to fit into their lifestyle and schedules. Would they actually want to read a 200-page book, or would they want something a little bit more digestible? Indians are incredibly value-conscious, especially when it comes to their online reading. I knew I had to give them books under a dollar. And so my company was formed and it was born. It was a platform where we created a list of stories designed for the smartphone, but it also allowed amateur writers to upload their own stories so they could be showcased along with the very writers they read and admired. And we could also enter into other people's digital platforms. So imagine this. Imagine you're a receptionist, you've had a long day of work, you book your cab in your ride-hailing app, it shows up, and you get into your car and you lie back on your seat and you put on your app, and you find a set of stories waiting for you, timed to your journey. Imagine you're a gay young woman in a relatively conservative city like Lucknow, which lies near Delhi. There's no way your parents know about your sexuality. They'd completely freak out. Would you like lesbian love stories written in Hindi, priced under a dollar, to be read in the privacy of your phone? And could I match readers to the events that were taking place around them in real time? So we published biographies of very famous politicians after they won big elections. When the Supreme Court decriminalized homosexuality, an LGBTQ collection was waiting on our homepage. And when India's Toni Morrison, the great writer Maheshwata Devi, died, our readers found a short story by her as soon as news hit. The idea was to be relevant to every moment of a reader's life. Who are our readers? They're mostly young men under the age of 30. There's someone like Salil, who lives in a city where there isn't a modern bookshop, and he comes to our app almost every day. There's someone like Manoj, who mostly reads us during the long commute back home. And there's someone like Amit, who loves our nonfiction that he can read in a single sitting, and they're priced very low. I live in a country the size of Europe, and it only has 50 decent bookshops. And Indians just didn't seem to want to read for fun. So if you look at all the bestseller lists in India, what you'll always find in the bestseller list is exam and professional guides. Imagine if you found the SAT guides as the New York Times number one seller month after month. And yet this smartphone revolution was creating readers and writers of a different kind. Whether it was on Facebook or WhatsApp, Indians were writing and sharing and reading all kinds of things. Terrible jokes, spurious pop history, long emotional confessions, diatribes against the government. And as I read and shared these things, I wondered to myself, could I get these writers and these readers, could I turn them into my readers? And so I left my plush corner office and my job as the publisher of India's top publishing company. And I set up on my own. I moved into a large room, single large room, in a cheap bohemian district of Delhi with a small team. And there I set up a new kind of publishing house. A new kind of publishing house needs a new kind of reader and a new kind of book. And so I asked myself, what would this new reader want? Would they prize urgency, relevance, timeliness, directness, the very qualities they seem to want from their online services, indeed the qualities they seem to want from life today? I knew that my readers were always on the go. I'd have to fit into their lifestyle and schedules. Would they actually want to read a 200-page book, or would they want something a little bit more digestible? Indians are incredibly value-conscious, especially when it comes to their online reading. I knew I had to give them books under a dollar. And so my company was formed and it was born. It was a platform where we created a list of stories designed for the smartphone, but it also allowed amateur writers to upload their own stories so they could be showcased along with the very writers they read and admired. And we could also enter into other people's digital platforms. So imagine this. Imagine you're a receptionist, you've had a long day of work, you book your cab in your ride-hailing app, it shows up, and you get into your car and you lie back on your seat and you put on your app, and you find a set of stories waiting for you, timed to your journey. Imagine you're a gay young woman in a relatively conservative city like Lucknow, which lies near Delhi. There's no way your parents know about your sexuality. They'd completely freak out. Would you like lesbian love stories written in Hindi, priced under a dollar, to be read in the privacy of your phone? And could I match readers to the events that were taking place around them in real time? So we published biographies of very famous politicians after they won big elections. When the Supreme Court decriminalized homosexuality, an LGBTQ collection was waiting on our homepage. And when India's Toni Morrison, the great writer Maheshwata Devi, died, our readers found a short story by her as soon as news hit. The idea was to be relevant to every moment of a reader's life. Who are our readers? They're mostly young men under the age of 30. There's someone like Salil, who lives in a city where there isn't a modern bookshop, and he comes to our app almost every day. There's someone like Manoj, who mostly reads us during the long commute back home. And there's someone like Amit who loves our nonfiction that he can read in a single sitting, and they're priced very low.
This is the end of the listening test.